Okay, good morning. Welcome back. Let's learn a little bit today. First of all, I'd like to thank the sponsors of this morning. I'd like to thank Mr. Tibi Schwartz, who's sponsoring Le'ilui Nishmas, his father's Yahrzeit, which is upcoming in a week and a half on Yud Shvat, Aaron ben Yaakov Shalom. Thank you for sharing the limud with us this morning. Also, we're going to be learning with the sponsorship of Dr. Honigman, Le'ilui Nishmas Tzipora Bas Ephraim Lipa. Yahrzeit is... That was last week. Thank you for sharing the learning. It should be, again, the limud should be Le'ilui Nishmasa and Le'ilui Nishmasa. Today we're also learning for the anonymous sponsorship, Le'ilui Nishmas Gedalia ben Menachem Yehoshua, whose Yahrzeit was last week. Our limud should be an Le'ilui Nishmasa. And we also learn Lirfua Shlema for Chaya Esther Bas Rachel Blima, who's undergoing a procedure this week, and Metz Hashem, it should be one with tremendous success. Metz Hashem. So let's begin our learning. We are at the 15th parasha in the Torah. So if you are counting, starting from Bereshis, Parashas Bo is at the 15th parasha. Now, what is remarkable about this is that the first 14 parashios have a sum total of zero mitzvahs. Now, it does happen to be that there are hints towards mitzvahs. We do talk about Avraham Avinu being commanded in Bris Milah. The Torah does talk about Pru Uravu. There is the mention of Gid Anashe. But as is pointed out, we don't keep those mitzvahs because of what Avraham was commanded, because of what Yaakov was commanded, because of what Adam or Noah were commanded. We keep those mitzvahs because after the giving of the Torah, they were reaffirmed. But nonetheless, even if you're going to measure them and count them as mitzvahs, and that's their source, there is a dramatic difference between up till the 15th parasha in the Torah and the 14 parashas preceding and Parashas Bo. We start Parashas Bo. There are a sum total of 20 mitzvahs in this week's parasha. 20 mitzvahs, so that, meaning there's an abrupt change, which is why sort of the narrative is diminishing and the commandments are increasing. So this is a decisive point in the Torah's, we'll call it tone and direction, which is why Rashi at the beginning of the Torah, and many of the Mepharshim say, we should have begun from Parashas Bo. Let's start from all the mitzvahs. Cut to the chase. Why all the stories? Right? And Rashi and all the Mepharshim deal with why it is necessary to be able to have the first 14 Parashas. But what Rashi is essentially attacking and arguing with is the fact that really the commandments really start now. And we see this in the makeup of this parasha. Now, if you're to look very carefully in Parashas Bo, most of those 20 mitzvahs have to do with the commemoration of Pesach, the commemoration of the Exodus. And there are a lot of mitzvahs which deal with the Exodus, not just the Exodus, but even a whole lot of them are to deal with the Paschal Lamb, with the Korban Pesach. So it's within this context, in this saturation of mitzvahs specifically relating to the Korban Pesach, which our discussion begins. We're going to take the opportunity of here to learn a famous idea together, not just outside as we usually hear it. We're going to take an opportunity to learn it actually in the text itself. But before we do this, just to appreciate the power of this piece of text that we're going to learn. Is the first source is really a source of what Rav Aaron Karlina, the Rebbe of Karlin, would say. He would advise that the section that we're about to learn to his students should be learnt off by heart. He would tell his students to learn this next section of the Sefer Achinuch off by heart. Ukeshem sha'amase ose pu'ula ala machshava shebelev liyos tova v'zocha gam dibur b'tora v'avoida hama'or shebo machzir es alev l'muta. He says, just by learning this, if we frequent ourselves to learning this idea, it will in fact change us, as the idea itself argues. Okay, so this is a very significant piece of Torah that we're going to be learning. Now, it happens to be this piece in the Sefer HaChinuch is also going to be very helpful. The Sefer HaChinuch was written by an unknown author. Some people attribute it to Rabbeinu Bachaye. There were two Rabbeinu Bachayes. This is one of the Rabbeinu Bachayes that it's attributed to. Nonetheless, we aren't 100% for sure who it is. We do know that he is clearly as a student of the Ramban, because a lot of his thought processes are very much in the school of thought of the Ramban. So oftentimes when you want to understand what the Ramban is saying, we can look to Rabbeinu Bechaya on the Torah, or we could look to the Sefer HaChinuch in his explanation of recounting that Ramban. What is lesser known about the Sefer HaChinuch is that it was written to his son. Right, this was actually an essay written to his son, so people make this a, you know, this is a serious limud, you know, to learn the Sefer HaChinuch. What he does essentially is he distills all of Torah into the 613 commandments, and he does it by parasha. So you can go to a certain parasha and say, okay, how many mitzvot are in the Sefer HaChinuch? Let me read them through. And what he does is there's a very basic framework. He talks about what the mitzvah is. He talks about what he calls the shorshei ha-mitzvah, the roots of the mitzvah, which are the foundational parts of the mitzvah, the thought. Then he talks about dinei ha-mitzvah, the laws of the mitzvah, and finally the applications today. Where, when, who. That's how he does it. And that's the framework for every mitzvah, and it's very useful. And sometimes he'll give us a little more in the shorshei ha-mitzvah. Sometimes he'll go out of, you know, out of the regular size of the mitzvah and give us a whole long essay. So if you want to appreciate what, like, you know, blessings, brachos, go to the Sefer HaChinuch in Parshas Akev, and he has a whole long essay about all the categories of brachos. Really, really fascinating. So here is where he steps sort of out of character of describing the mitzvahs, and he actually turns to his son. So this turns into a conversation between father and child, and this is what we're about to learn. So I believe we're all the children of the Sefer HaChinuch in that respect. So we're all on the listening end as he turns to us and says, listen to me, my son. So this is where we're going to start. If we have the pages, this is on the bottom of page 1 in the box. This is the Sefer HaChinuch Mitzvah 16, Mitzvah Tes Zayin. And this mitzvah that he's commenting on is the mitzvah of not breaking the bone of the Korban Pesach. One of the halachas, one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, the 613 mitzvahs, is that we don't break the bones of the Korban Pesach. There are many reasons given to this. One reason that he is not focusing on so much right now is the idea that, you know, we're kings. So when you come out of Egypt, we're not going to break the bones, because when you break the bones, of course, you break the bones of a animal to get to the marrow, right? So when we're kings, we're not going to be like, you know, sucking up the last pieces of marrow as if we desperately need every last piece of sustenance from this animal. Right, we can eat the meat and live the high life. We don't need to sort of, you know, go down to that level. But nonetheless, when commenting on the Sefer HaChinuch now explains this mitzvah to his son. So we're going to start on the second paragraph, and he says the following: Va'al tachshov b'ni litpois al devorai v'lomar. So he says, my son, don't think of questioning me by asking the following. Why, Dad, do we need to have so many mitzvahs about Passover? I mean, let's get over it, right? Give one significant commandment, one commemoration, one ritual, and that ritual will encapsulate everything to do with the Exodus. He says, because this question that you have is not one of wisdom. And this is a question of youth to ask such a question. So if anybody ever thought of that, he's telling us it is a question of youth. I'm going to tell you a rule of how the Torah and mitzvahs work. This is very important for all us to understand. Da, he says, you should know, ki ha'adam, humanity, nif'al kafi fu'ulasav, is activated via their actions. V'liboy, and a person's heart, v'kol machshavosav, and their thoughts, so their emotions and their intellect, tamid achar ma'asav, shehu oisebohem, is dependent on what you're actually doing. Im tov v'imra, whether those actions are good or not so good. V'afila rosho goma b'levovoy, call rak rak. So let's say you have a terribly evil person who spends the whole day, you know, brooding on negative and terrible thoughts. If such a person will force themselves to lead a life of goodness, so whether they spend all their day thinking about bad things, but they're forcing themselves to do good things, then even though they're doing those good things not for the right purposes, miyad, this is a remarkable statement, immediately. Now, we have to think about how immediate that immediately is, right? But there's going to be, a yinte el hatov, a person will turn towards the good. They'll be pivoted over. A person will be able to subjugate sublimate their inclination to whatever else they were brooding about during life. This is the more famous quotation that he has, "Ki acharei ha'pu'ulos nimshachim halevavos," because after actions, the heart are drawn. That's his argument. Now, that's a drastic statement, his example here, right? The bad person doing good actions is going to become a better person. Let's not say a good person, but a better person, right? So this is the argument. Now, he's going to give a few examples. Let's say the other extreme. So you have a person who's a tremendously righteous and pious individual. And a naive and straight heart, right? A person who's just pure-hearted person. Really wants to do the right thing. He's a Jew at heart. Let's say that person involves themselves in actions of negativity. Let's say the government forced this person to be involved in negative jobs, in destructive jobs. BMS, in truth, if their entire day is spent doing negative things, extorting, hurting, killing, then even though they may have been a righteous, well-thought-out, altruistic individual, by the end of the day, they are going to be turned. People's emotions are controlled by their actions. The leverage of a person's emotions is their actions. That's why the sages taught us, the Gemara in Makos, the very, very end, which we passed recently in the Daf Yomi, Hashem wanted to give us merit. That's why Hashem gave us lots of Torah and lots of mitzvahs. In order to try to affect our minds. These are all just training grounds to be able to educate us emotionally and intellectually. To be good for us in the end. Because through those good thoughts and what it turns us into, transforms us into, that's how we merit into the world to come. What a beautiful way of looking at things. This is important, by the way, because one of the many questions that we can have on Torah is that the Torah doesn't just command us to do. The Gemara doesn't just demand from us to speak. The Gemara demands from us to feel. Right? So an example, the 10th of the Aseret HaDibros is Lo Yisachmo, don't envy, don't covet. Such complicated translations, right? Anyways, don't envy, right? So how exactly am I supposed to reach? How exactly am I supposed to not envy? I see what he's driving, right? I see what she's wearing, right? Meaning like, right, I'm looking at this, I'm feeling because I'm seeing, right? How can I control that? So the Sefer HaChinuch's suggestion over here is that actions will control ultimate feelings. So if we act in a way which is, we'll call it divergent from the way we are feeling, we can ultimately affect what we're going to be feeling next time. That's his argument. Right, as opposed to those, by the way, just as a footnote, as opposed to those like the Ibn Ezra, who moved more in a cognitive approach. Ibn Ezra's example, and this is moving just a little bit aside, just to appreciate how the different psychological models are applied. Ibn Ezra says, how do you access not being able to covet somebody else's property or their lifestyle or their successes? Well, he says, imagine that you were a poor person living in the far reaches of the kingdom in a village which is not even named on the map, right? That's where you live. And one day you're tilling potatoes in your backyard, and the princess drives past in her white limousine, right? And the limousine is so long that you can barely see the front from the back, and she's passing by, and the window's open, and her hair is waving in the wind, and this poor man looks up from digging his potatoes, which is what he's been doing since he was the age of 3 years old, helping his father. And he has no prospects to ever get out of the potato patch, and he sees the princess. Is he going to say to himself that I would like to marry her? And the answer is no, because his aspirations, there's simply no way that he can imagine himself in this unmapped village in the side of the kingdom, looking up at the princess's white limousine, to think that he ever will have a prospect of this, no matter what Aladdin will tell you. Right? So now, so that means to say that the Ibn Ezra says is that our expectations essentially inform or control the way we think, right? So if we can change the way our life expectations, meaning to say if our life expectations are not to have what he or she has, then we don't look at it as something which we wish we could have because The aspirations simply aren't there. So we don't control our emotions, we control our aspirations. Right? That's a cognitive approach. That's what Ibn Ezra says on the 10th Aseret Divros. The Sefer HaChinuch is not saying that. Do you notice this? He's saying, don't work on the aspirations, the expectations, we'll call it the cognitive film through which we see the world. He says, work on something very tangible, and that is the way we act. Work on the way we act, and that affects how our emotions are going to be affected, or going to ultimately flow. But just to appreciate the difference in those approaches. Now let's go a little further. Just to appreciate this. Now he's going to start talking towards his son, who's obviously clearly a upcoming teenager. And I'm sure this is the kind of conversation that we've all had. Wish we had at some points with our children. Here's what he says. We just skipped a paragraph from the period. He says, "V'ramzu zikron livrocha al zeba ma'amoram." He quotes the Gemara in Menachos on Daf Mem Gimel Beis. Kol mi sheyesh lo mezuzah b'pischa v'tzitzis b'bigdo v'tefillin b'roisha muftach lo shelo yachta. A person who has all the mitzvahs, right? A person who's doing all these mitzvahs. They have a mezuzah, tzitzis, tefillin for those who wear it. Is promised not to sin. Lefi she'elo mitzvahs t'midiyos nifal bohen tamid. If a person is always involved in them, a person is not going to sin. We're going to have to ask ourselves, is that really true? Right? We have to, as one of the questions when we're dealing with the Sefer HaChinuch is that true? Do we notice that everybody who does all these things does that, right? That's going to be one of the questions we're going to have to ask on this Sefer HaChinuch.
It's filling Berosha in the cup, not just on the head.
Okay, very good. It has to sink in, right? Very good, very good. So we have to see, it's not 100% sure that this Gemara should be taken at face value, but nonetheless.
Behavioral and cognitive psychology.
All together. Behavioral and cognitive psychology all together. So therefore, he turns outwards to his son, and I believe that we're the audience listening to this at the same time. He's breaking through the third wall here. He says, please see, my son. He says, make careful note what you're doing in life. Because whatever you're doing is going to lead you to where you are. You're not going to lead your actions. Your actions are going to lead you. So make sure you've got a good audit on what's going on. Don't say, I'm such a good Jew at heart that I know that I believe in God and I think of Hashem all day. So what difference does it make if I hang out in the marketplace? Right, and to hang out in the nightclubs, right, and to talk, to have those kind of conversations. Is it real? Can you show me black on white where the problem is, Dad? Right, where is it written that you can't go to a nightclub? Right, is there anything, any problem over there? Like, I'm not doing anything wrong, right? So he says, What problem should it be if I just, I just hang out with these people? Okay, they're a little sarcastic. Okay, they talk a little bit of a different jargon, but it's, right? They're regular folks. Albany, please, my son, don't. Be careful of them. Apparently, teenage problems were not just now. We're talking in the 13th century, sorry, the 14th century right now, right? Okay? So he says, tilaked bereshtam. You're going to fall into their nets. Rabim shosu mitoch kach toet kois tarilom. Tarilosa. Many have drunk from their cup of anger, va'ato, or their poison. Va'ato al es nafshecho tatzil. Save your soul. Va'achar da'atcho ze al yikshe olecho me'ato ribui ha'mitzos bi'inyan zechiras nisei mitzrayim. Shem omud godol b'toro seno. He says, just remember, think why the Torah had impressed upon us so many mitzvahs to do with Korban Pesach. Because the Torah understood that it takes a lot of action in order to be able to affect emotion. So understand how a lot of your action can affect your emotion. And this is sort of his plea to his son. As you're growing up, be careful where you hang out, what you do, who you hang out with, how you speak. Because these kind of things are going to internally affect you. That's his argument. And it's just such a, you take a moment to appreciate, the struggles, that parents face, at the same time the hadracha, the guidance which he's trying to give his child. Now, this Sefer HaChinuch is revolutionary in so many ways. This is very well quoted, and I'm sure many of us have heard the phrase, "Acharei ha'pu'ulos nimshachim alevavos," What I want to do is to like, think about it. First of all, it's just important to see it inside. What we just did just briefly, to read through, just to hear him speaking it, not somebody quoting him. But let's go a little further now, just to appreciate a few backgrounds. What I want to do is the following, just to see, to sort of map this out a little bit. I want to reverse a little bit, just to see previous descriptions of the same rule. Fast forward it to see some applications of that rule. To see some of the outcomes of what that rule applies itself to life. Those are just a few short steps. And then to look at some psychological models of how that actually works today, meaning to say, why is that? Why is this rule true? And then to think about the limitations of it, because it's clear this doesn't work all the time, right? There are many good people who have been trying to do good things, and doesn't always make the cut. And finally, maybe to see just a halakhic application of this as well. So just like a few different arenas. The Sefer HaChinuch was not the first person in Torah thought to have said this. He is interpreting, of course, Chazals in a certain particular way. When he looks at the idea that Hashem increased many Torah and mitzvahs, right, to give us the Olam Haba, he's saying that's because it affects the emotions, right? So he's reading it into his framework, but that's not the Chazal, wasn't specifically saying his role. But we do see, even like a little while back, about a century earlier, we see the Rambam describing similar ideas. The Rambam in Shmoneh Prakim, in his introduction to his Pirush on Pirkei Avos, says the following. This is the Rambam himself, who says, "Vada, you should know, she'elo amalos ha'pechisuyois, asher lemidos lo yagil v'lo yisyashu ba'nefesh, rak b'chfol ha'pu'ulos ha'boiz min amido ahi pa'amim rabois." No, the Rambam has been talking about certain values. Certain good values, certain negative values. He says, these values will not really arrive in the nefesh. They'll not penetrate your soul, your intellect, unless b'chfol ha'pu'ulos. What's the word k'fol? When you do them multiple times.
Perpetual.
Right, these become a perpetual practice. Bizman oroch, or regilos bohem, that you get used to them. V'ima yo ha'pu'ulos ahem tovois, yeh magia lanu mehem ma'ala. So if you repeatedly practice a particular action for the good, you're going to ultimately end up where you're acting. And if you do it for the negative, you're going to end up where you're acting as well. So the Rambam, this is well before the Sefer HaChinuch, in the same idea. There's lots of values. How do we get values to be inculcated? It's via the process of doing it many times. In later day, just to fast forward a number of centuries, just to see the applications. This is beforehand, afterwards. The Mesidas Yesharim, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, in his famous book, the Mesidas Yesharim, The Way of the Just, says the following. In interpreting this, he says, "V'omam yisbonenu." He says, "Shekamoy shazrizus, who toledes haislahatus hapanimi." Just as zrizus, so alacrity, is a product of an internal brent, like an internal burning to do something right. Kain minazrizus yivoleid haislatus. Doing something excitedly kindles the brent. Right? Don't think, and this is such a mistake that humans make, right? We say to ourselves, "I'm not feeling it. I just can't do it." So what does the mystic Mr. Shoyim say?
Keep doing it
and you will feel it. That's how what's happening. Vahainu, kimi shemargish atzmo b'maase ha-mitzvah. A person who feels while doing the mitzvah, kamoi shehu memaher tenu aso achitzono, ki hinehu gorem shetiva boi tenu aso hapanimis, kamoi kein, v'acheshe v'achev yisiskaber boi v'yelech. So let's say you say, "I'm going to do this. I want to do this. I'm going to succeed in doing this." And you go, and you succeed. And you afterwards you say, "Wow, I feel great, right? Because I did it. I feel like I succeeded." Why? Because you decided you're going to... your behavior is triggering your passion. Ach, imisnaig bechvedus v'tenu aso vorov. And you walk in with your hunched shoulders and your dragged feet and your lowly posture. Then gam tnuas ruchot yishkav tichbe. All the flame around you and in you is going to be put out by that. So he says, "How do we know this? Because experience teaches this." Meaning, you don't have to go so far to know that this is true, right? How do you want to change? Change. Rav Kook famously said that the first step in the process of spiritual tshuva of return is physical return. Go to the gym, take a walk, do something. Now we know today that the body releases endorphins, right? We see the physiological effects of this. What Rav Kook was saying is do something. When you start doing something, it ultimately affects what you want to be doing. It's a very hard cycle to break. When a person's in a in a spiral, it's very hard to be able to say, I'm going to act excitedly, I'm going to act, you know, passionately when you don't feel it. Right? But ultimately, what the Siddhas Hashemi says, that's the way to break the cycle. It's a very counterintuitive idea, but this is the application of what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying. So, happens to be that some interesting applications of this. So, Dr. Nachama Leibowitz, in her first essay on Parshas Bo, actually talks about this particular Sefer HaChinuch, and she makes a very strong comment. Comment number one that she makes is that doesn't leave so much space for people to say, I was just following orders. It's interesting, interesting point. Meaning to say, it could be that a person will say to themselves, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, I know the government told me to do such a thing, and this is why I'm doing it, and I'm not to blame. Now, it could be culpability may be a question, right? Because ultimately the person didn't have a choice. But having said that, on the other side of years and years of terrible actions, that person becomes a terrible person. Whether or not they chose to enter into that. You know, there's a book which I'm trying to get through right now called Hitler's Willing Executioners. Following orders, right? Following orders. That's not always the case. Now, forgetting the question of civil disobedience, whether people have the right or not, or have the ability to be able to protest or not. But nonetheless, the question is how does that affect a person? Meaning what Dr. Leibowitz is saying is that don't underestimate even forced actions and how they affect the psyche. I remember when I was growing up, you know, people used to ask me, you know, how was it with the Jews in South Africa and the apartheid and so on, you know? And it happens to be that most of the resistance to apartheid was led by, you know, Jews and communists. Nelson Mandela's Rivonia trial lawyer was Jewish, of course. And, you know, many of the heads of the communist movement, Joe Slovo, who was assassinated in the 90s, all Jewish people, right? It happens to be there are many, many Jews. But you should also appreciate, you know, it's a very difficult situation. I remember that my father had a very close friend who was the head of the ICU in Johannesburg General Hospital, very, very big and respected hospital. And, you know, he would be brought, you know, so he was in charge of the entire ward. And, you know, one day he was brought in a prisoner, you know, a black man who was brought in chained to the bed with two policemen. And so, you know, and he had to treat this person for whatever, he was caught in crossfire for something. And he told the policeman to step out the room, meaning like, you know, this is my ward and I'm going to tell you how things operate here. And they said to him, he says, doctor, you be very careful. Meaning to say, you're like, you know, people disappeared in those days, you know? People, you know, you disobeyed the government, you disappeared, that was it. You received a parcel bomb when you went into exile. That's how things work. So it's not simple. But at the same time, you know, what he's saying is that don't think to ourselves that just going with the flow is going to leave us unchanged. That's what he's saying. And that was what the example, the Sefer HaChinuch himself gave. If the government tells you to, right? That was one of the examples. This is going to affect us. Another application of this that Dr. Leibowitz points out is this explains something very important. And that is that when Bnei Yisrael, what was the greatest zechus that Bnei Yisrael had when accepting the Torah as opposed to all other nations was? Na'aseh v'nishma. He says, isn't that exactly that point? Na'aseh v'nishma means, I don't get it, HaGad. I don't understand it fully. I don't know what's fully written in it. I haven't read all the footnotes in the small writing yet. But you know what? I'm going to do it because I'll get there. I know that you know what's best for us. And I don't know fully all of it, but I'm going to do it because I'm going to get to the nishma part afterwards. Right? That was exactly the point, is that sometimes that's how we have to behave in life, when we know we're going in the right direction and adopting it. So these are just some interesting applications that she makes mention of. I thought they were just very, 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 very fascinating to make mention of. Now, how does this work, technically speaking? So, like, what psychological processes are actually unfolding in the person? It is fascinating. Psychology is a very interesting field, which today, and with a lot of research which has been done, is actually approximating just the truths the Torah told us axiomatically many years ago, right? I mean, you say the Torah has told us that there's certain ways that work, and psychology is now showing it in research that this is the case. So how does this work? Meaning, what processes are actually working? So I have a friend who is of mine, who I was actually chavrusa with. His name is Rabbi Yoni Gold, who lives in Chicago now. He's a head of programs at Hillel Day School, and was psychology undergrad, and I believe he's finishing his master's now in behavioral psychology or industrial psychology as a teacher and as an administrator. And he wrote an essay, which he gave to me a number of years ago, and he attacked this point, and he made three suggestions, which I thought were just really fascinating. So I'm not going to profess that this is my expertise, but I do think this is just interesting because it does actually affect how we think about this. So the first idea is the idea which is called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance, so as an example, there was a famous essay written by Leon Festinger on this particular topic in 2008. But of course, he was not the first person to talk about it, but here's a brief abstract in the sources that I included. Here we are. This is cognitive dissonance was first investigated by Leon Festinger, arising out of a participant observation study of a cult which believed that the earth was going to be destroyed by a flood. And what happens to its members, particularly the really committed ones, who had given up their homes and jobs to work for the cult when the flood did not happen. While the fringe members were more inclined to recognize that they had made fools of themselves and to put it down to experience, committed members were more likely to reinterpret the evidence to show that they were right all along, that the earth was not destroyed because of the faithfulness of the cult members. So what that means to say is that the general argument of cognitive dissonance, and again, oversimplification, there's much research and there's much more complicated than this, is that when we're doing something and we're thinking something different, there's a dissonance between those two ideas. Meaning, it's very hard for me to be doing something which is not consonant with my thought process. So what the human being or the belief, so what the human being is going to do is they're going to convert one or the other. Meaning, if my actions are going in a particular way and I believe something else, I'm going to very soon convert what I'm believing to be consonant with my actions, to reconcile so that there's no stress. Cognitive dissonance is a product of stress, ultimately, where there's a dissonance between what I'm doing and what I'm thinking, what I'm believing, and I'm going to resolve that by changing one of them, right, in order to be able to resolve that. That's what cognitive dissonance argues, and this is an interesting idea, which means that according to this, if we apply this idea to the Sefer HaChinuch, for a moment, this is just an interesting thought, which actually, before we even get there, an example, it's just an example of how this works. When students are doing a survey of professors at college, right, as an example, they've found that there's a correlation between the amount of work in the course and the higher ratings of the professor, which is interesting, which means to say that the higher the course load of work, the higher the ratings the student gave to the professor, obviously within a range, but that means to say that because a person, let's say a student applied themselves that semester, and we're not talking about a student who did no work, a student applied themselves that semester, that means they had to do a lot of work for this course. They had to do a lot of the work, they had invested a lot for this course. So if there's a cognitive dissonance for saying that this is a bad professor, or this is a bad course, when I had to do so much investment in this course, right? So they found there's a correlation between the high ratings of the teacher and the high course load. That was just an interesting thing. I don't know what that says to all the professors in the audience, right? You know, about the next semester and so on. But there we go, load them up, exactly. It works to a point, exactly. There is an overload point.
There also has to be a reward factor in it.
Correct.
There has to be a reward factor.
Correct. So we're going to get back.
Recognition of the work you put in.
I want to go, there's two, yes, great. So there are two parameters I want to introduce in just a moment to this, which make a difference. But anyway, this is cognitive dissonance. So how does this apply? So if you think about this for just a moment, what the Sefer HaChinuch was suggesting, the Sefer HaChinuch is saying is that you are a person, let's give a basic example. You feel that you're not a generous enough person, right? I feel like I don't give enough charity. So the Sefer HaChinuch says, what's the solution? The solution is give charity, right? So it means to say is that as opposed to giving an end-of-year donation as the all the emails come in about the end of year, give on a daily basis, give on a weekly basis, and you regulate yourself to being a giving person, and slowly it'll change you by the end of the year. You wanted to become a giving person, you are a giving person because you're being a giving person, right? The cognitive dissonance is I can't carry on thinking that I'm a stingy person if I'm doing it all the whole time, right? That's what's happening psychologically, whether it's subconsciously or consciously. That's argument number one. There's another sort of a little bit of a more subtle approach, which is what's called, which is suggested by Dr. Daryl Bem, which is called self-perception theory. This is an interesting way of looking at things. What the argument is that it's not so natural thinking. He has an abstract on this particular article. Self-perception theory is counterintuitive. Common knowledge would have us assume that a person's personality and attitudes drive their actions. However, self-perception theory shows that this is not always the case. In simple terms, it illustrates that we are what we do. According to self-perception theory, we interpret our own actions the way we interpret others' actions, and our actions will often socially influence and not produced out of our own free will as we might expect, which means, just as a simple example, so if I see, Fred, licking vanilla ice cream and smiling, I observe, and my perception, therefore, of Fred is that Fred likes ice cream, right? Because I see him eating it, and I see him smiling, and the body language is telling me that he likes it. So now what happens if I'm looking in the mirror, and I see me licking ice cream and smiling? So I now, my self-perception of myself is I must like ice cream because I'm doing it. Right now, that means to say that we are almost, in a certain sense, the observer of ourselves like we observe others. So if we're doing the right thing, then we notice that we're doing the right thing, and we feel like we're doing the right thing because we're observing ourselves. It's just it makes ourselves both the doer and the observer at the same time. Very interesting idea. Notice that the difference between self-perception and cognitive dissonance is that cognitive dissonance is bred from a situation of stress. Self-perception theory doesn't need stress. There doesn't need to be a dissonance in order for you to be able to change. That's an important distinction between the two of them. But that's the third suggestion that Rabbi Gold makes, which I thought is a really interesting one, is what's called grounded cognition, or what we call today embodied cognition. Embodied cognition is a very complicated subject, and there are many people who argue what it is in one particular way, and many others who argue that it's a little more narrow. What we're likely to hear about embodied cognition is that the way we act is, in a certain sense, the way we think is affected not just by our brain, but by our surroundings and by our body. Okay, now that's a bit of a broad way of describing it, but that means to say the examples given are that a person who wears a lab coat actually scores higher on particular experiments than a person who's not dressed to show. A person who smiles experiences more happiness than a person who doesn't smile. I mean, to say the way we act is actually affecting the way we store ideas in our brain and the way we perceive things. It's grounded in our environment and grounded in what's around us. Now, it's not 100% clear because there are examples. You know, like there's what's called, a strong stance. You know, so if a person stands legs apart, hands on their hips, that it's been shown in a certain research that, testosterone levels rise after 2 minutes of being in such a position, meaning to say the way I'm standing, the way my position is going to affect the way I act and feel and think, right? Because of the position, the posture of how I go about life. It's a little more complex than that, just to be fair. And that is that the real grain of embodied cognition means to say that I don't just think with my brain and apply it to my limbs. I actually perceive with my body more than just my brain. That's that, just to appreciate this. But nonetheless, not to get into the depth of this idea, that means to say that the embodied cognition of here is part of the way that we experience this. Now, why is it important to know this in the end of the day? Meaning to say, like, whatever mechanism we can attribute this to, why is that important? The answer is because some of the mechanisms provide different parameters for us. And this is going to be important for understanding the parameters of this rule. So here's an example. Let's come back to the grinding question. Wait, we're running out of time, so let's try to get close over here. So, the grinding question is: you can have a person who's doing, Torah 24/7, going to davening, doing the Torah, doing the mitzvahs, doing Shabbos, doing Yom Tov, and they're still of a moral decrepit nature, right? I mean to say, a person is still living a life of just decay, and. What's really happening? Didn't the Sefer HaChinuch give us this ironclad guarantee that do the right thing, you become the right person, right? You start thinking the right way. So what happens? Now, I just want to, before even going further, it is important to notice the difference between ritual and interpersonal mitzvahs, just to appreciate this for a moment, right? A person who's doing all the ritual stuff doesn't necessarily mean to say it translates into the interpersonal stuff. Those are two different planes, right? There's what's called the vertical plane and the horizontal plane, right? So that's just something to bear in mind. There are lots of people who are excellent ritual practices and they are terrible interpersonal practices, right? So, and vice versa. So that's one thing to bear in mind. But still, having said that, we still know that a lot of people who do things and it doesn't work. The example that Rav Elia Lopian gives is that the Russian army service, conscription was for 30 years. Can you imagine this? People complain about the Israel conscription, 3 years, right? 30 years was the Russian army conscription. They would take boys who were 15 years old, they were to be returned back to home at the age 45. Imagine that, right? So he noticed something interesting, and that is after a regiment of 30 years of army training, people who would leave the army would leave the army and just return to what he calls batlanim. They would just sort of lead a life of couch potato afterwards. They couldn't leave the bar, you know, vertical. They couldn't get hold down a job after being in the army. And he said, what happened to all that discipline? What happened to all that regiment? Surely after, you know, that amount of, you know, regulation in life, you should be able to, it should have affected you, right? Asking really on the Sefer HaChinuch's premise, right? That amount of action should really at least seep into the way you lead the rest of your life, right? So his argument is, and this is a very important point, is that this rule only applies when we want to be doing what we're doing. Meaning, I want to be a generous person, and I know I'm not a generous person. So what do? I start giving even though I don't feel it. But you know what? After a while, I'm going to start feeling it because I'm doing it. That's what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying. But what happens if I don't want to be a generous person? And somebody else has got a gun to my head and is saying, you're going to give. So what's going to end up happening? Not only am I not going to become a generous person, I'm going to spend all my time, you know, mulling over why that person is forcing me to give. Because I'm not giving because I chose to give. I don't want to be a generous person in the end of the day, right? So therefore the process itself is not going to have the cognitive effect necessary to be had, which explains something. So if the person isn't interested, and the argument is made in Parshas Kisavo, after all the curses are given, the terrible 98 curses of Parshas Kisavo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Tachas Asher Lo Avadet Hashem Elokecha V'Simcha V'Tzuv Levav, because you didn't serve Hashem with happiness. Now, like, happiness is important and everything, right? You know, but like that important? Like, you know, we're talking about a Holocaust. You know, like that's what the Kisav was talking about. Because of happiness, meaning like that's a cherry, right? Isn't that just like the best part afterwards? Like, you know, okay, good. Life quality in this country is great. No, so Rav Elia Lopin says no. If we're not enjoying what we're doing, then what we're doing is not affecting us, right? Meaning, like, let's say I'm doing all the 613. It's impossible. No one person can do all 613. I'm doing all the mitzvahs that affect me, right? And I'm doing it. I'm leading that life, but I'm not enjoying it. I don't care about this. It's not me. My enjoyment is found elsewhere. It's found when I get out of shul. It's found when I get out of life. That's where I enjoy myself. So then you're not really affecting yourself, right? Meaning you're not achieving anything. In fact, you may be like the Russian army. You may be waiting and kicking for the moment you can get out of it. And reverting away from that system which was forcing you into something. Which means to say, this is what the Maharal says is that action, when the tension is between Kofar Lehem Har Kegeges and Na'as Savanishma, the two parts of the acceptance of the Torah. One part of it was coerced, and the other part was our acceptance. The way he reads that Gemara is that if we're coerced into doing something, when Hashem forced the mountain over our heads, that's not really who we are. It's not going to really penetrate who we are, because even though we needed that guardrail, it was important for us, but that you can't say that's who I am, right? Because it wasn't me. It was forced upon me from the outside. What's the Gemara say is the resolution to that problem? What does the Gemara say in the Gemara Shavas Peiches?
Purim.
So how does so what happens is, the Gemara says, is that until the moment of Purim, until the times of Megillas Esther, of Esther and Mordechai, The Jews really had that coercion above their heads. What changed on Purim, like what the Maharal argues, is we created a new mitzvah, Mikra Megillah, meaning up to now all the mitzvahs had been, like, you know, forced down our throats. So is that going to really change us? No, not really. We came to Purim, we said, God, we love you so much, we're going to make new mitzvahs. We're going to have a mitzvah of Mikra Megillah, which has no roots in the Torah, right? There's nothing else. So it means that expression of love is an indication that it is us. It really was us. It did affect us. It wasn't simply the outside, we'll call it, framework which is forcing us. Now, this framework is what is called the framework of free choice, meaning to say we need to have enough free choice to own it that we become part of the process that's affecting us. But there's a balance. There is a balance of this. Even within this, there's a spectrum. So, for instance, it's been shown psychologically that, let's say, a group was assigned to give charitably to a particular institution. So they didn't choose the institution. And they didn't choose, right? They didn't choose necessarily the activity they were doing, but they do it, and they buy into the activity, even though it was somewhat forced. They still feel feelings of altruism afterwards, which means that a certain degree of force is important. So, like when educating kids, you know, you can't say to kids, "Well, we know that if you don't have free choice, you're not going to really buy in, so you can come to school whenever you want." That doesn't work, right? I mean, so they have to come to school. There has to be a guideline, but within the guideline, maybe there's space for a little bit more buy-in so that they're able to be part of this process, because otherwise it's not affecting. hard balance to achieve. One last parameter, which is worthwhile thinking, and that is cost. Okay, going back to Dr. Huberfeld. It is interesting that to the degree there's a cost is the degree that this rule of the Sefer HaChinuch is active, which means that the more I'm required to invest, and investment doesn't necessarily mean money. Investment means persona, time, energy to something, the more likely I am to be indebted to that thing. What Rav Dessler argues in the first section of Mirta Miliyahu is that we do not love, we do not give because we love, we love because we give, right? Which means to say that the more we choose, let's say there's a particular individual who you do not get along well with, and you decide, I want to make up to this individual, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to every Friday give a phone call. I'm going to send flowers on an anniversary, whatever it is. So I'm investing. I don't like this person. I really don't like this person, but I'm trying to be like this person. So because I'm putting a cost, I'm investing into this person, that's going to now slowly shift me to liking this person because, or this entity, or this thing, or this institution, or this community, because I'm now investing in that. So the higher the cost to a degree before it's backbreaking, there's of course a parameter over here, to the degree that I'm investing more, the more this rule is actually operating. Which means, this is just an interesting point, that as opposed to coming back to that professorship for a moment, as opposed to thinking the more space and easiness I give, the more they'll like it, the more I invest and make them invest in it, the more they will actually be in, they'll be invested in that, and the process will kick in of the Sefer HaChinuch. One last just interesting application, this is La Halacha. You know, you say, well, this is really applied to La Halacha. So there's a set of responses called the Mishnah Halachas by Menashe Klein, who lived till very recently in Brooklyn, who asks the following question. There's a Mishnah Lemelech who asks the question. The Gemara says that a person is allowed to lend to his children beribis. Kedei lahatimom tam ribis. Interesting thing. The Gemara says the person is allowed to lend to the children ribis with interest. Now, generally speaking, you're not allowed to lend to other Jews with interest. The Gemara says lat imam b'tam ribis. They should taste of ribis, the importance and the value of time as it converts financially. And the Gemara says v'lav mihil sehi mishum da'asi lemisrach. Don't do that because you're going to come back to slide back. You're going to sin. So, you know, meaning like not a good idea. And it's not a good idea for many reasons, right? But the Gemara says, the Asin Mishrach. What does that mean? So the Rashi says is that the children are going to start getting used to borrowing with interest, and that's what's going to end up happening. They're going to start getting into this system. And what the commentators on Rashi ask is why are you worried about the kids? Worry about the parents, right? Meaning to say there's two victims in the system over here. Is the person who's lending with ribis, and the person who's borrowing, the person who's lending. Why aren't you worried about the dad or the mother who's lending to their children ribis? Mm-hmm. So the Mishnah Melech suggests is because he quotes the Gemara in Pesachim. The Gemara in Pesachim says that a person is allowed to search for chametz on Erev Pesach after the time that its time is ban biur chametz, right? So generally speaking, there's a time when you have to burn chametz. You are allowed to search for chametz to destroy it after that time in the day. Why? Because the Gemara comments, it says, machzer olav l'sarfa michal achal minei. You're going to destroy it. You're searching out the chametz to destroy it. You're going to make a mistake and eat it. You're going to make a mistake. The reason why you're searching for it is to destroy it, right? So in a certain sense over here, what he's saying is the father's not going to make the mistake. He's just showing them how this works. It's not going to be something which the father's going to fall into the snare of. It's the children will as well. Says Rav Menashe Klein, doesn't make sense. You can't make the comparison. Listen to the brilliance. He says, ultimately speaking, he quotes the Sefer HaChinuch in full in the next paragraph, and he says, because we know that acharei ha'pu'las nimshachas halevavos, that our actions will dictate the way we feel, the parent is equally likely to fall into this snare. He says, it's different to the Gemara in Pesachim, where a person is allowed to search out chametz after the Zman Biur in order to destroy it, because their intentions in that case are good. When a person is lending to their children ribis, their intentions are questionable. And when your intentions are questionable, then the rule, right, then the rule of acharei ha'pu'las nimshachas halevavos actually applies itself in the negative way here, because again, the intentions of the actions define the way it's going to affect you. That's what he suggests. So he has to explain why does we're not concerned about the father being involved. But he says it doesn't make sense to say that this is a holy, notable, and honorable activity, and therefore a person is immune to the effects of it. Which comes back to exactly the idea. La halacha, he's saying, is the direction we've chosen for ourselves, and therefore the actions leading towards that direction are going to affect us. But if we don't choose that direction, the actions aren't going to may have much of an effect on us at all. Just fascinating applications of this. Oh, this is food for much further thought and discussion. Thank you so much for being here today.
You're a great psychologist. Just beautiful delivery. This is my field.
Oh, my field.
Sure.
I got to talk to you.